Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:35 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is March 24th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with the two-year yield in the USA. It's down to 3.77%. But I think by far the most important characteristics here are that we had the downside weekly key reversal 3 weeks ago. Last week, we had a follow-through on the downside, and that was a profound move because it broke the succession of higher reaction lows. And in aggregate, this is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Therefore, it is a type 2 top formation. Now, there are a couple of different characteristics that we discuss at the chart seminar about these type 2 top formations. We describe it, or I guess, and I definitely find myself saying we, even though I'm doing it on my own and I have been teaching the chart seminar and I was on my own since 2007. But the reality here is that when we look at this kind of development, it's the proverbial bolt from the blue. So it's a massively surprising event. And it then catches people by surprise. And then they start to think, well, it's already moved a lot. So is there anything to be gained really from buying now? Because obviously this is a yield. So the yield goes down, price goes up. So buying now, considering that it's already gone up so much already. And then has anything really changed? So the two-year yield coming down like this is pricing in the potential that interest rates are going to start coming down quickly. But then we had the Federal Reserve basically saying this week that that is not going to be the case. So here we have this question that the bond market is basically betting that the Federal Reserve is wrong. And they're not going to be in a position to continue to raise rates, but rather that the challenges that are erupting in the banking sector are going to be something that they're just not going to be able to ignore. And of course, then the Federal Reserve is pointing towards inflation and saying that it has not come down as much as was hoped. And then we have jobless figures, which were actually up, were down. And so unemployment figures were better. Jobless figures were down this week. And then the demand for homes actually went up in February, despite the fact that the mortgage rate is still really quite high at over 6.3%. There was ample demand for housing in February. So when the Federal Reserve looks at all that data, well, they're going to conclude the economy is still in fine fettle, and there's no real need or urgency to curtail their interest rate hiking cycle. But that, of course, would be to ignore the really quite acute downward pressure that's coming to bear on the banking sector. And I think this is really particularly worrisome because let's drag this chart all the way back to the mid-2000s. So banks did especially well in the aftermath of the peak in technology in the early 2000s, and but then they peaked in 2007. And it took a couple of years, but by the time we got to 2009, they had lost the majority of their value. And then US banks pushed on to new high ground right at the end of 2021 and are now pulling back and doing so in a rather dynamic manner. And then let's zoom in here. We can now clearly see that for the first time in quite some time, the 200-day moving average is falling down through the 1,000-day moving average. And we haven't really seen that since 2020. So there's definitely some there's stress here in the banking sector. Now, there was a Fortune article over the last 24 hours stating that there are $1.7 trillion of unrealized losses in the US banking sector. And that is obviously then going to raise questions. Where are those losses focused? Well, they're going to be in the bigger banks, they're going to be in the smaller banks because every bank was buying bonds. And the profound move that we've had in the bond yield over the course of the last 2 years means that anyone who was buying bonds between 2018 and 2021 is underwater. So the degree to which they're underwater is obviously going to be different depending on which bank we're talking about, but they're all experiencing losses. So the one problem is, of course, that they don't want to sell those bonds. So there are two reasons for that. They don't want to crystallize the loss. So that's one. But then the new program that the Federal Reserve set up would buy those bonds at par. But the problem, of course, is that if you paid over par for the bond, and let's just look at these futures, the 10-year future today is trading at 116. Back in 2020, it was 140. And all the way from 2014 all the way through to 2021, it was trading well in excess of 120. So even if the Fed is willing to buy them back at par, well, we should be looking then at lots and lots of back history, because the only time that US Treasuries traded, or the future traded at below 100, or at least the most recent time, was in 2000. And then you have to go all the way back into the late 1980s to get into those kinds of levels. So when we then just put up the current 10-year bond, we can look at the price. It's still at 101, and that's obviously with a meaningfully higher coupon. So that is one issue. But the fact that the coupons on the bonds that were issued between 2018 and 2021 were so low, it means that the price is much more volatile relative to interest rates. A point that I had been making, golly, it feels like a long time ago, but it's at least 5 or 6 years ago, is that the bond market was giving absolutely no consideration to convexity. Well, all of the decline that we've had in the last year is about convexity. It's the sensitivity of the price to interest rates. And when you have a very low coupon, then convexity is something that really becomes problematic. So what we've definitely seen is that a lot of demand has come through for for funds at the discount window. And now the big question is, are we going to see substantial action? So when we go back and think about the banking sector, Janet Yellen made some statements earlier on this week to the effect that they were not she wasn't all that keen on backstopping all deposits. Now, of course, backstopping all deposits basically turns banks into post offices. And the whole point of putting your money with a government-backed bank is that your deposits are 100% guaranteed. But then, of course, post offices don't offer a lot of racy kinds of services. You can't exactly get a mortgage from a post office. So then the whole question of whether banks are in fact independent or whether we live in a free capital markets type of economic system comes very sharply into focus. And then, of course, there's also the big question of moral hazard, because if banks are 100% backstopped by the government, there is nothing to stop them from going way out on the risk curve. So then the big question is about regulation. If all deposits are going to be backstopped, then the big question is, how are banks going to be regulated? And that type of regulation takes a long time. So we're still very much within the crisis portion of this development. And Janet Yellen is currently meeting with the heads of regulatory bodies. So it looks like over the weekend, then what they're going to do is to come in and say that the deposits in banks in the USA are now fully backstopped by the government, and that this has been discussed over the last week or two, and that it is going to be at least for a given amount of time, potentially a year, potentially longer. Of course, when you start introducing these kinds of guarantees for a year, it also then is going to raise the question, how on earth are they going to remove them in future? But that is likely to be the emergency kind of news that will be brought forthcoming this weekend. So we are seeing at least some risk on activity as a result of that speculation. But the fact that they are willing to backstop the deposits does nothing to obviate the risk that there are still huge losses sitting on their balance sheets because they were buying these bonds that were very susceptible to convexity risk, and then have that they're sitting now with very low prices. So they don't want to sell them at par, because they'd even then be taking a loss. So this means that banks are going to be inhibited from providing credit. So when we think then about some of these commercial real estate properties, well, this is a California-focused REIT, and it's accelerating lower. So this is where some of the focus of attention is starting to come into now, because not only do they have this clear risk from the absence of people inside office buildings and the very high prices attached to those office buildings and the complete dependence on justifying that high price of very aggressive rents and then companies not paying them, it means that they're going to have to get written down. And this is obviously problematic, because that's just one company. And then you've got Brookfield Corp, which has been one of the biggest investors in commercial property worldwide. And the share is a little bit steadier in here today, but it's still a clear downtrend. So we can see where there are clear there's clear evidence right now of the selling pressure, and that there's risk-off activity within the banking sector because of tighter lending conditions. But the most important factor to remember is that banks are liquidity providers, and we should generally expect banks to do well in a bull market environment, because bull markets thrive on liquidity. But when liquidity dries up, well, then it's reasonable to anticipate that then bull markets will also end. And that's pretty much where we are right now. So this significant underperformance of banks is definitely something that we need to pay attention to. And then, of course, it really begs the question, where is the big source of new liquidity going to come from? So European banks are generally expected to do better at hedging their interest rate risk. I saw a report from Fitch today talking about that. That has not stopped them from pulling back in an aggressive manner. And whatever about hedging their interest rate risk? How much of the risk from all those negative yielding bonds going to positive yields, 18 trillion in value over the last 18 months has really been hedged by these banks? Because the cost of hedging that kind of exposure is really quite profound. Now, we have certainly got some speculation going on right now in Deutsche Bank because of its exposure to CoCos, which are the conditional collateral bonds. And the reason that Deutsche Bank is being focused upon is because it's not particularly well run, but they've had significant issues with their CoCos in the past. So there's a clear bet that this situation isn't, they're not going to have avoided it, and that they're sitting on significant losses. Now, Deutsche has failed to rally for more than 5 years. And if we zoom out and look at the back history, this looks like a terminal decline. And there are only two listed German banks. So if the trouble gets too difficult, then it will be nationalized. And then there will probably be only one. And who's to say that Commerzbank will survive as a public entity? So there's absolutely no reason to own Deutsche Bank. And it's probably not going to be all that fruitful to short it either, because Germany has a long practice of banning shorting when things start, when shorting would be most profitable. So then, obviously, the question is, are we going to see additional sources of liquidity being provided? So the size of the Fed's balance sheet popped on the upside last week, and then it also appreciated this week. So this is certainly a turn upwards. Now, I think it's important to look at how we've seen these kinds of events occur in the past. We saw a period of quantitative tightening between 2018 and 2019. We had an initial pop on the upside, and it's worth also reminding ourselves that the low was about 3.72. After the initial pop, it had gone up to 400, so about 300 billion, which was about half of the entire quantitative tightening program. And then when the crisis hit in 2020, well, then the size of the balance sheet basically multiplied, and or at least not far off it. So now we've had the first pop on the upside, where it has unwound about half of the quantitative tightening program. And the whole reason for having a bullish attitude towards asset prices right now is because one believes that when the recession actually does start, then the size of the Fed's balance sheet is going to multiply, and that it will be at 15 trillion in no time at all. And we've seen similar kinds of situations in the past where any effort to try and reduce the size of the balance sheet results in a big pop on the upside. So nothing has happened to suggest that the addiction to liquidity has changed in any way. Then let's look at the long-term outlook here for the global central bank balance sheet. So the important point is that it's dollar denominated. So all of those international balances have been redenominated into dollars on the chart. Now, then what that also suggests is that the outlook for the dollar has a material effect on global liquidity, and the dollar is coming back down. So when we look at this index, it has found support, and it looks like 20 trillion is about as low as it's going to get. Now, when the Federal Reserve talks about the ramping up of the size of the balance sheet and saying that it is not quantitative easing because of where those funds actually ended up, that is a bit facetious because we know that markets look at the size of the balance sheet and conclude that it's inevitable that if they start increasing it, that trend is likely to continue. So, with the dollar rolling over, it is likely to provide ample liquidity to the rest of the world. But the dollar was in positive territory today. And what this is also highlighting is that if they provide additional liquidity now, then they're not going to get in control of inflation. And if they do that, then their ability to cut interest rates will be inhibited. And if they can't cut interest rates, then that's going to support the dollar, but would be less of a support for asset prices. So we're in this sort of catch-22 environment. I do think that it is likely the dollar has peaked in the short term. The only question really is how long are we going to see some ranging going on? But ultimately, the outlook is for a deflationary shock, because that's generally the reason why they start to cut interest rates in the first place. It's because they are no longer worried about inflation, they're worried about deflation. And I think it's rather interesting here to look at where some of the factors that were contributing to inflation have subsequently traded. So the Baltic Dry Index came all the way back down to the lows in 2020 and then rebounded over the last 4 weeks. And now it's at the first area of potential resistance. So obviously here is a question now. Is it going to pop on the upside here? Because if it does, then that's probably going to be more of an indication of healthy global growth and more exports coming out of China than any other factor. But then I do wonder whether it is going to be a lead indicator for container shipments, which have collapsed in value. So the 40-foot container has now dropped back down to below 2,000, and it was in excess of 20,000 in 2021. So if we're going to see a similar outlook here for what happened with the Baltic Dry Index, the chances are that we're pretty close to the lows here. Now, the next question is going to center on oil. And oil prices dropped this week. Now, they have steadied up a little, but began to roll over yesterday and are now encountering resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So, this is a meaningful breakdown from an inert period of trading. And then the question, of course, is going to be, with so many bullish factors for oil, and some of those include that OPEC is producing less, Russia is producing less, and then we also have the fact that the majors are investing less in new supply. So that's going to create a supply inelasticity environment in the future. Why is it that oil prices are falling now rather than appreciating? Well, of course, the answer is demand. And with all of these credit concerns that we have in the banking sector, both in Europe and in North America, then there's a clear potential that demand for oil will moderate because there'll be less economic activity. So That does suggest that we're going to see lower prices for oil, and the trend is certainly pointing in that direction. We have a clear succession of lower rally highs, ranges one below the last, and resistance in the region of the major trend means. And that then also translates into a big question for the wider stock market, because the energy sector was far and away the best performer in 2021 and 2022. And now it's rolling over. And so the price was mildly positive in here today. And now the big question is it going to be able to push back up through that 200-day moving average? And I kind of doubt it. I suspect that there is certainly the potential here that we're going to get a surprise on the downside from the energy sector. So we're at a very delicate situation in terms of the wider market. But what this also, of course, means is that there is a clear risk of a recession, and that is particularly true for the USA. Banks' performance is negative. And then the yield curve spread, having contracted in a very meaningful way, the 10-year minus the 2-year has appreciated. Now it's only negative 40 basis points. So this, and I will zoom in and just look at the daily chart. We can see that it is starting to push higher from here. Now, we have not seen the wider market paying much attention to this because the 10-year minus the 3-month hasn't gone up at all. And it is still at a negative 124 basis points. So it was actually at a new low in here this week. And we have to go back and look at an awful lot of history to see when the spread was at such low levels. Now, I think it is particularly relevant to highlight that the 10-year minus the 3-month was also at a peak, at a new recovery peak in April, May of last year, and then subsequently collapsed. It's much more volatile than the 10-year minus the 2-year. And when we look at the 3-month yield, well, we can think about why that might be. Because investors are not quite yet willing to bet that the Federal Reserve is going to be cutting rates 3 months from now. So the Fed funds rate is at about 5%, and the 3-month is at 4.6%. And it was off the lows in here today, and it was off the low from Monday as well. So, what the in the very short term, bond investors are betting that we're not quite yet at the interest rate cutting period of this market. But they're not willing to bet that there's going to be more interest rate hikes either. And when we look at that futures curve, well, it does look more likely than not, and we can basically look at that, but that 6 months from now, they're anticipating that yields will be lower. And 2 years from now, interest rates will be significantly lower. So I do think then that there is clear potential here that we're going to get a deflationary shock. We know what happens with quantitative tightening. And if quantitative easing increases and the rising of the Fed's balance sheet and central bank balance sheets increases the potential for inflation, then contracting the size of those balance sheets creates deflationary forces. Now, of course, right now, the size of the Fed's balance sheet is increasing again. But we're still likely to have a significant deflationary shock. We'll likely have then bond yields starting to come back down. That's why I've been happy to hold on to my longer dated bonds because I do think that my entry point was reasonable, and that the more likely scenario is that we're going to see yields contract potentially for the 10-year down towards 2%. Then subsequently, we'll get a new inflationary trend. And I suspect that that is what we should anticipate. Now, it's worth highlighting that the S&P 500 is so far at least failing to push back above the 200-day moving average. And if energy prices do roll over, then that's going to remove one of the primary sectors that were providing assistance to the performance. Now, we've been ranging for about a year, or at least 9 months, and it did break the succession of lower rally highs. So that's a positive. And if ranging can be sustained, that's an exceptionally benign outcome. But if it starts pulling back down through the 1,000-day moving average, then the argument about whether we're in a secular bear market is going to be much more compelling. Now, I think it is also worth just paying attention to the Dow Gold ratio. I don't believe this has nearly as much predictive power any longer that it had in the past, because the long-term cycle has been broken. And let's just recap what that long-term cycle was, because historically there were about 36 years between the peaks. And well, we're now in 2024, so if we're going to get another peak that's higher than this peak in 1999 before 2036, then stocks will have to start rebounding in a really profound manner. Instead, it looks like we've had a lower high, and now we've had another lower high, and now we have lower lows. So gold is outperforming the Dow, and on a ratio basis, it has come down from about 22 to 16. So this is pricing in that the longer term cycle, where we see stocks outperforming for the lengthy long term, that they can go on these secular bull markets that last decades at a time. That's no longer supported by the performance of the ratio. And instead, it is looking more likely that commodities will outperform the stock market, and most particularly gold. But on this occasion, it is much more about the devaluation of the purchasing power of fiat currencies, rather than, and of course, then also the fact that stock valuations are high. So we have certainly got the potential that a secular bear market, where we get a generational long period of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, that could be unfolding. So it really is absolutely imperative that the various stock market indices continue to hold their respective 200-day moving averages, and excuse me, 1,000-day moving averages. And that was a big trend in consistency in 2020 for the Dow, that it pulled back below the 1,000-day moving average, even though it rebounded and went up to new highs within 18 months. What we often see is that a big trend will lose consistency at the penultimate high. Well, the peak in early 2020 was the penultimate high. Then we had the inconsistency. Now we're at a very delicate period of time, and we have banks that are underperforming, and we have inflationary pressures that inhibit central banks from cutting rates aggressively. So they are certainly looking for a deflationary outcome. They want to try and curtail the inflationary pressures by reducing, the number of jobs that are available back to something that is commensurate with the number of workers that are available. Now, that's n probably going to be quite painful. And that, of course, is what one would associate with a recession. Now, that, of course, is also part of the liquidity cycle. Now, of course, in right now we also have geopolitical considerations because of the war that's going on in Ukraine, where we have NATO basically aligned with Russia and with China. And China is basically playing it safe right now and not providing Russia with armaments. But they are supplying them with funds by buying an increasing quantity of their oil, gas, and other resources. But they are at least not going to fall into the same kind of trap that Europe fell into by relying on Russia for all of their energy imports. So that's, I think, basically where we have this potential for risk mitigation, because everybody is looking at this deteriorating relationship between the USA and China, and the focus of attention right now on TikTok, and whether it is an organ of the Chinese Communist Party's administration globally, that's rather moot. I think one of the good reasons for banning not just TikTok and some of these other social media venues is because of the impact that they have on the mental health of the younger generation, and particularly teenage girls. But that isn't exactly a geopolitical consideration, but rather something that is potentially right and proper. One thing that's definitely been at the back of my mind for the last couple of years is whether you can actually have value or better value in the stock market without values on the social front. And social values have deteriorated in line with interest rates. So I do wonder, if we are moving into a more of an inflationary cycle, then will we see more, I guess, a return to more conservative social values? That's obviously not a question for markets, but it is something that could potentially occur as interest rates back up over the course of the next decade. Now, of course, that then it also raises a big question. Are we really in a new inflationary cycle? And what does that mean for asset prices? I think what's going on in France right now is particularly instructive. Now, it's very easy to simply look at the headline and question why are they protesting so violently when it's really only moving the retirement age from 62 to 64, and lots of other countries have higher retirement ages. But the determination to do that is based in trying to accept the most common sense way of trying to balance budgets over the long term and make pensions affordable. The alternative is either to embrace much more onerous problems in the future, which would be even less politically palatable, or to basically default on providing a better standard of living and to deflate the purchasing power of the currency along the way. Well, we know that the 10-year total return index has broken its uptrend, and the 200-day moving average is miles below the 1,000-day moving average. And that's the first time that's happened in 40 years. But bonds are rallying, and the total return on bonds has broken back above that 200-day moving average, and it is pushing up towards the 1,000-day. So there's obviously the potential here that we're going to get at least a recovery rally in bonds. And then the big question will be asked about how far can this rally go? And are we going to see a deflationary outcome? So I think some of the deflationary forces that we should be considering are that there is no groundswell of young people, and older people consume less on aggregate. So and I guess that's very difficult to accept right now, because we're coming off the pandemic when there was a massive increase in consumption in most of the Western world. And of course, that was enabled by this massive quantity of cash that was provided to people at the same time. I don't think we're going back to that. I don't think that there's going to be the same kind of social transfers, because we know what that dalliance with modern monetary theory has contributed to. And that's generally beneficial for bonds. And then we also have the potential that technological innovation will continue to have a deflationary outcome overall. And of course, that's one of the primary reasons why people have been so eager to bet on artificial intelligence. Now, of course, there's a lot of promise in the artificial intelligence theme, and we haven't really seen it commercialized. We haven't really seen that that companies are adopting it in a big way. And of course, there are very big questions about social cohesion and displaced workers. Of course, what ideally it would mean is a huge jump higher in productivity. And it would literally potentially have a significant effect on enhancing the inventive and productive capacity of lots of other sectors simultaneously. The primary areas where artificial intelligence have already been used is in drug discovery and the kind of difficult chemistry problems that AlphaFold was able to complete, and DeepMind completed for Google, in terms of trying to figure out how the or what is the 3D composition of proteins. So those kinds of questions are perfect for artificial intelligence. Trying to come up with more subjective answers to subjective questions is more of an art, and that is also something that artificial intelligence is now being applied to, and the results from that are going to be spotty, and that's to be expected because we're dealing with subjective material, subjective answers. So that then is the question, is how to monetize that. And are we moving, is it more of a solution for social media, or is it something that will be integrated into the commercial sphere? The one thing though is that if bond yields do not collapse, then funding for these kinds of speculative ventures becomes more expensive. Now, some of the more speculative ventures are very much centered on small modular reactors. So we've seen that companies attached to that sector, like Rolls-Royce, is right at the upper side of its space, and General Electric, as another industrial company, is at the upper side of its base formation. And they're both big industrial companies. So, from a geopolitical perspective, and then looking at the volume of cash that's being thrown at the The geopolitical question. These kinds of dual use companies, where they can build power plants, they can build nuclear reactors, but with a bit of retooling, they can also build drones and weaponry. These companies are completing base formations. And then we have steel companies that have been going sideways for a profoundly long period of time, also steadying in the region of their own base formations. Now, if we are moving, if the decline in the Dow gold ratio is indicative of a change of direction for stocks and more focus on value versus growth and more on bricks and mortar and very clear physical attributes rather than ephemeral growth, well, then that's likely to contribute to some of those more industrial, heavy, real world, I guess, dirt under the fingernails type of manufacturers doing better. But when we look at the performance of value relative to growth, value has staged a strong rally in 2022 and given up a lot of it in 2023 so far. And then if we look at the performance of the exceptionally large cap companies relative to the entire market cap of the USA, well, then it has also rallied very impressively and pushed up into that overhead trading range. So this is a clear bet by investors that interest rates are going to peak soon and the market will be flooded with liquidity. And that is also why Bitcoin has rebounded. I was watching an interview with Cathie Wood earlier on this week, and she was really waxing lyrical about how well Bitcoin had held up during the banking crisis. But Bitcoin's a liquidity barometer. It's nothing to do with whether it is a transaction mechanism. The price goes up when there's a lot of liquidity, or and it goes up in advance of a halving event, which burnishes its supply and elasticity credentials. So the next halving is going to be about a year from now, and it's quite normal for the price to rebound ahead of that. And that's exactly what we've started to see this year. But that is much more of a bet on liquidity. And it is worth highlighting that it's usually from a cyclical perspective after the halving that we see a massive swell of new money hitting the market. Well, if one is going to then think about the timing of a recession, that interest rates might hold up for another 3 to 6 months, and then subsequently we'll see interest rates coming down, but that the real big flood of liquidity would be in 2024, and that would be right around the halving. And that's just simply from Bitcoin's cyclicality and this almost lockstep 4-year cyclical phenomenon of massive liquidity being made available in response to either a crisis or a big change on the fiscal front, because the big move in 2017 was around the Trump tax cuts. Now, if we then think about this effort to supply the market with liquidity, the fact that the industrials are popping on the upside, and then I think it is also particularly relevant that currencies like the Indonesian rupiah have put in a higher reaction low and appreciated meaningfully in here this week. And the Mexican peso is breaking out to new recovery highs and found support this week in the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, this is clear evidence that money is flowing into these markets, and the rationale is pretty clear, that if the global manufacturing sector was all China for the last 20 years, well, then it's China plus one now. And those plus ones are increasingly likely to be either the Indonesian market, and the Jakarta Composite is bouncing from the upper side of its range. Could also be Vietnam, although a lot of manufacturing has already found its way to Vietnam. The market there is bouncing from the 1,000 level after a steep decline in 2022. And then Mexico. And in nominal terms, the Mexican market is right in the region of its peaks and beginning to steady. If we look at these same markets in US dollar terms, the Mexican market has found support in the upper side of its base formation, and the Indonesian market is firming within its range. I think that these countries are in a very benign position, sitting basically between two global superpowers and benefiting from both. And they will also benefit from being courted by both of those superpowers. So that's likely to lead to foreign direct investment moving into countries like Indonesia, Vietnam, Mexico, potentially then also Brazil, South Africa, and Nigeria. So that also is likely to benefit from the regional currencies putting in a higher reaction low. And the Asia dollar index has rebounded and is attempting to find support here around the 100 level and the low from back in 2020, but it has been going down for a decade. So if we are now changing the trend, if the dominance of the US market is going to wane with this question about liquidity and the question about valuations, then there's obviously then the potential that other places will do better. And gold breaking higher, commodities generally being stronger. Of course, then also begs the question, are we going to see significant new infrastructure development moving into renewable energy? So, copper prices continue to hold here around the $4 area, and there is still a sequence of ranges, one above the last, and it is bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. We have the Inflation Reduction Act in the USA. There are certainly efforts underway in Europe to further enhance the investment in renewable energy, and China is looking at attempting to electrify its economy, and they're still investing in coal plants, but at the same time, they're not, or I guess they are attempting to focus more on electrification and then obviously concentration of power production capacity in certain areas rather than every high-rise tower burning its own coal, or it's having a chimney. But it does then, of course, beg the question, where are all the resources going to come from for that electrification? They're obviously going to have to be lots more high-tension power lines built. There's going to have to be a lot more copper mined, and the price could go up significantly. Now, I think there's going to be a lot of push and pull, and whenever prices go higher, then there'll be some reticence to continue to invest. When prices come back down, then there'll be plans to go off and build more. So we're going to have a lot of ebb and flow in the trends for commodities. But something that is certainly worth highlighting right now is that several commodities are starting to push on the upside. And we'd had quite a bit of commodity weakness in the early part of this year. But orange juice continues to march higher. And it was up the limit in here today. And this trend is gathering speed. And this is a really significant breakout. So we had significant hurricane damage and flooding damage in the orange groves of Florida this hurricane season, and subsequently prices have continued to march higher. And now also we're seeing Robusta coffee starting to appreciate as well. And that was up in a dynamic manner this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. And that's a big upside weekly key reversal. So what we are starting to see is more activity on the soft commodities side of the commodity complex. Now, this is not all going to play out at once, but we have to at least consider that the kind of volatility that we're getting in commodity prices is in part because we have more people, and in part because it's more expensive to produce. And we have more regulation. So all of those factors are contributing to the relative strength of the agricultural commodity base. And then we also have the dollar. And if the dollar rolls over, then it improves the outlook for just about all commodities. But from a food perspective, the fact that climate conditions are changing, and that we have lots more people living in water-stressed areas, and we have a lot more building going on top of agricultural land, and we have evidence of more variability in climate, and now agriculture prices are holding at higher levels overall. So there are several contributing factors in this strength in agricultural commodities. And it's also, of course, contributing to inflationary pressures. Now, it's, there were events in the past, like the anchovy harvest in the 70s, failing because of, it was, I can't remember if it was El Nino or La Nina events. And then that contributing to some inflationary pressures. So we know that these kinds of events do happen. I do think that it is more likely than not that having really let out the inflation genie, putting it back in is going to be exceptionally difficult. I think that it is more likely than not that we're going to have a succession of short, sharp cycles, and that we'll get a couple of years on the downside, a couple of years on the upside, that we're going to go through painful periods of inflation, deflation, rising rates, cutting rates, and that's likely to mirror the kind of activity that we had in the 1970s. The geopolitical environment does not look like it's going to get better. The China plus one is less efficient than just China. Costs are likely to rise. And the more likely scenario is that as global growth deteriorates, oil prices will go down. That will even further disincentivize producers to invest in new supply. So then prices will surge again, and we'll go into a more volatile inflationary outcome overall. Now, of course, that's potentially benign for property prices, potentially benign for even commercial property prices. not in a straight line. And we're likely to have a boom bust cycles that happen in very short succession to one another. So I think that's potentially something that we do need to be prepared for. And it is likely to foment a more of a trader's perspective. And that suggests too that the long decade long bull market that we've had for the last well really for 15 years isn't likely to be repeated, and we're going to move more into shorter term cycles, and that some of the bigger moves are likely to happen in commodities because of the reticence to invest. And then we can think too about the performance of some of the big oligarchies within the mining sector. So BHP Billiton has pulled back from its peak and it failed to sustain the upward break. So the base case is that it is going to come back and test that 1,000-day moving average. But this is not unusual. These types of shares, they have historically had sawtooth profiles, which means that they are best bought following the big reactions. There's no market that exemplifies that than better than in India. So India has been a buy-the-dip market for decades, and I don't see any reason to think that that isn't going to remain the case. And the Nifty index is coming back down now, having also failed to sustain its breakout. So a reversion back towards the 1,000-day moving average is looking more likely than not. And the more back history that we look at, well, we can see that there are blindingly few examples of when the Nifty has sustained a move below the 1,000-day moving average since about 2003. But it is quite overextended in the short term. So there is certainly the potential that we could get a reversionary process. But India is also a major potential beneficiary of at least a China plus one strategy, but potentially more than that because of the size of its domestic population, the swell of young people looking for a better standard of living, and the clear willingness of NATO in particular to support the Indian economy in an effort to create a competitor to China in the region. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and I'll wish all the best to all of you.